Monday night edition of the pod. I want to start actually by asking you guys a favor, which is the number one thing you could do to support our show right now is to use that cap space code to get 20% off at Wish. They are, as you know, are sponsoring the Twitter NBA show, and they're going to be deciding whether to renew pretty quickly here. So Wish is great. You get fantastic deals there. You can buy basically anything that you want at Wish for outstanding prices. And if you use that cap space code, even if you use them before, you get 20% off whatever you're going to buy. So hopefully that'll be a win-win for both of us, but it's not often we'll straight up ask for favors like this, but this is one that definitely is going to really matter to us. Today, we're going to get back to doing some gamers, not a ton of trade news. We got that Bucks-Nets deal to discuss. We'll get to that first. And then we're going to talk about Utah and New Orleans, see how Nikola Mirotic is looking in his new home, and then also Detroit and Portland, check in on how Blake Griffin is looking as a Detroit Piston. But first, Danny, we have a trade to announce.
Yeah, I mean, when I created the original joke of gotta catch them all for the Bucks, it was originally only about the Plumleys, but now I think it needs to be the Zellies, because now they added Tyler Zeller. So the trade is, it's kind of an interesting structure just for a couple different reasons, but so it is Zeller straight up going to the Milwaukee Bucks, who included Rashad Vaughn, who they already declined the fourth year option on, and a future second round pick. And what's weird is they had to trade it kind of around the protections of the pick that they already owed to the Phoenix Suns. So basically, if the Suns pick conveys this year to Phoenix as part of the Eric Bledsoe trade, then Brooklyn gets Milwaukee's second in 2020. And if it's the reverse, then Brooklyn gets it this year.
Yeah. And going back to the Bledsoe trade, it's interesting because you'll recall the first rounder in the Bledsoe trade is protected 17 to 30 this year. So if it's above 17 or 17 or above, I should say, it doesn't go. But then that second rounder is set up. So essentially, if the Bucks finish somewhere where the first rounder doesn't go, then the second rounder will go, because that second rounder is protected for the first 16 picks of the second round. And so what they are trading is the second rounder, if it does not fall in the first 16 picks, I'm sorry, if it does fall in the first 16 picks of the second round, and then if it does not go this year, then you go back to a 2020 unprotected second round pick. And so the Bucks giving up a second rounder, maybe it doesn't go till 2020, which of course requires a discount. If they don't make the playoffs or at the very lower end of the playoffs, that second rounder could be okay. You know, it's usually once you get past about 45, second rounders seem to become a lot less valuable just in terms of the type of player that you can get. So they paid a price here, and what'd they get?
They got an unspectacular but still solid third center who is on a non-guaranteed contract for next year. So the upside of that is that it's basically team control. They can choose whether they want to have him or not. The downside, though, is that it means that since the contract is multiple years, it's not subsidized by the league in the same way. It counts on the books at the full amount, and he's not that good. So they're getting something. And then what makes this move so striking to me is it looks a lot like a small improvement in a tax avoidance move, except that via the Eric Bledsoe trade, the Bucks got a lot more breathing room relative to the tax this year. So they didn't, you know, including Vaughn, sure, that makes it easier financially because you don't have to, you know, to pay the rest of his contract, but it's not like they needed to do that to deduct the tax or anything. And since Zeller's contract was at the minimum for 2 years or fewer, they could have just brought him in under a minimum exception if they wanted to.
I do think, however, that the inclusion of Vaughn is important, because while the Bucks still only created another $100,000 or so of room by moving on from Vaughn, who's making slightly more than the minimum, actually he's making a little bit more than that in terms of actual dollars, but counts on the books, because you'll recall it in the 2017 CBA, they bump up some of those rookies from the couple of years before then in terms of their actual dollars, but that gets paid by the league, so it doesn't show up on the salary cap books of the team. So they're pretty close. They're about $100,000 apart this year, so the Bucks save that. But instead of getting Brooklyn to take back that money, which it sounds like from Woj's reporting, Brooklyn is not really interested in Vaughn, and maybe he'll get a shot there, but and he's still pretty young, but looks like he could be on his way out of the league, as we thought when Milwaukee declined his option to begin with. But you now, because you got Vaughn included, instead of just having to waive him and take on that Zeller salary, you leave yourself still about $4.5 million below the tax. And it so happens that the Bucks have a fair amount remaining of their full mid-level exception, and they also have their BAE available as well. And so now they can be pretty competitive on the buyout market while at the same time having picked up Zeller. So
I think you know what the best position on the buyout market's going to be?
Yes, well, while we, I'm trying to present it positively from the Bucks' perspective. Well, I agree. I think they could have done
better. The other thing they have that could be significant here is they still have the Roy Hibbert trade exception, which expires late in February, so functionally at the deadline, and that is about $5 million. So they could also acquire a player by trade at about that amount and not go into the tax. So there are some avenues that could be open here. It's just that this seems like a move you do after you've tried everything else and it didn't work, as opposed to doing this 3 days before that, much less the buyout market.
Yeah, and perhaps also the appeal for Zeller was, all right, he's under contract at basically very close to the minimum next year, and he also has a very late guarantee date. Well, it's not one of those ones where you have to decide before free agency gets going. The guarantee date's all the way until the league-wide cutdown date next year in early January. So the thought is, all right, you know, we needed a third center. We can get this guy on the books for next year. He gives us insurance if we need to move on from John Henson for luxury tax reasons. And maybe that's a thought too. It's like, hey, John Henson's actually been playing pretty well, especially since they've gone to a more conservative scheme under Prunty. But maybe next year we got to start Thon Maker. We have to move on from Henson to avoid the tax if they're going to re-sign Parker. And Zeller gives them a cheap, cost-controlled option who, at least in their point of view, doesn't really suck that badly. I think that he's not really a quality rotation player. He has expanded his range out to three a little bit, mostly from the corners. He's 10 out of 26 on three-pointers this year. He still is a guy who can hit the mid-ranger. He's got an okay floater and hook shot game around the rim, not an elite finisher due to his lack of explosion. And then defensively, he can box out, but that's about all he does. He just provides zero rim protection whatsoever for this Bucks team. But again, maybe he's serviceable. You could say they needed a third center in case someone went down. But I tend to think that they could have maybe done better for trading a second round pick if they felt they needed a center. And maybe who knows how much of just taking back Vaughn's salary was part of the reason they had to do that as well. But some of the guys they might have gotten perhaps are not under contract for next year. And maybe that is the thought, just to kind of give yourself a floor at backup center next year in case something goes wrong. So I think that does have some value. This is a better deal than if he had not had that non-guarantee for next year, that's for sure.
Absolutely, and that's a feather in the cap for Sean Marks, that he created an asset out of nothing, basically. I mean, that was just a small amount of cap space.
Yeah, and Vaughn already has been reported unlikely to be part of Brooklyn's plans, but just so you know, because he had his fourth-year option declined, that means that should they want to retain him, the most they could pay him is the $2.9 million that he would have been due next year, and it's difficult to imagine a circumstance, especially in the tight 2018 market that we've foreseen, which he could be worth more than that, even if he blows up, relatively speaking, this year. So he'll probably just get into competition for minutes with Nick Stauskas as the fourth guard. Maybe if the Nets move on from Joe Harris at the deadline and try to pick up something for him, Vaughn could get a little bit more of a look there. And he still is pretty young, but certainly has not flashed much, if anything, as of now. So yeah, we'll get some more news here. But first, this from tripping.com. Staying in a rented vacation home, to me, especially if you have a group, whether it's a family or a group of friends, that's the way to go, right? How nice is it to just have a common area where you can all gather, you can save money by cooking food in the kitchen, you can live for a little while in an area that is maybe a little bit more off the beaten path, live more like a local than in the hotel district, and you can save a lot of money as well if you're not someone who's done this before. But one of the downsides of that process is, between VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, Airbnb, you had to go to a bunch of different sites. That is no longer the case now with Tripping.com. It aggregates those sites together, and you don't have to wonder anymore if you're getting the best deal either. You'll save an average of 18% per night by booking your vacation with Tripping.com. The way to get started with them, Tripping.com/capspace is your URL. That's Tripping.com/capspace. Easy to remember that /capspace URL. Talk about it all the time here on the program, including with this Titanic Nets Bucks trade today. That's tripping.com, tripping.com/capspace, to book yourself the perfect vacation rental. All right, we got some lower level news items here. Danny, what we got?
We can do a little injury roundup. Darren Collison is going to be out 2 to 3 weeks with a knee procedure, which sounds like a really short period of time to be out for when you're having actual surgery on your knee.
Yeah, arthroscopic surgery is what they said. And you know, it's always been, I mean, I think the last one of these that was like this short was Jan Mahimi maybe, but whenever it's less than 6 weeks for these surgeries, I'm always skeptical. I mean, for them to go 2 to 3 weeks, that's even less time than the low ends that we've seen. And so it must be a very small procedure. I don't know whether it's a cleanup. They didn't release anything other than to say arthroscopic surgery, so we don't know anything more than that. Collison was playing pretty well, and this is a blow for the Pacers, much the same way when one of their centers goes out. They have Corey Joseph as a very capable backup, but now you're bringing Joe Young into the mix as the backup point guard, and he hasn't really done much to show that he's a rotation caliber player yet in his career. Maybe we'll see more of Lance Stephenson playing in a ball handling role with the second unit. Perhaps that's how they will try to adjust for this. I don't think that the Pacers are necessarily in danger of missing the playoffs as a result of this, although Victor Oladipo missed today with an illness. That's a big part of why I think they lost. But Collison has been an underrated factor for them with his shooting, and they really need another shooter on the floor. And now if you're going to play, they'd play Lance down the end of games quite a bit at the three. Now if you're going to play Corey Joseph and Lance together, and Thaddeus Young is only an okay three-point shooter, now you're really going to struggle for spacing. So it limits a lot what they can do. Maybe they'll be a little better defensively with Joseph in some of those lineups, but not good for the Pacers, and we'll have to see where it is that Collison comes back. And when he comes back, is again, it was not supposed to be a big surgery, but you're always skeptical when someone goes under the knife.
Another challenge for the Pacers is just that sliding Stephenson, you can give him the playmaking responsibilities, but they don't have enough perimeter players to just be like, oh, well, we'll just play a non-point guard, you know, go solve that, the Joe Young problem that way. They just don't have enough guys. They are getting reinforcements eventually there. Glenn Robinson III, who's been out this entire season with an ankle sprain, a severe ankle sprain, he was assigned to the G League over the weekend, and then he was listed as questionable but did not play in the game against the Wizards, so he'll be on probably some crazy minutes restrictions when you miss that much time with an ankle sprain. But reinforcements are necessary for this team, and it'll be also different because they're, you know, we'll see how reliable he is shooting the three this year, but also just replacing Collison. That was part of what made them such a good shooting team, was that they just didn't have bad shooters on the floor ever, and no matter what, they're downgrading from Collison.
A few other notes here. Marquise Chris was suspended by the Suns after a verbal confrontation with an assistant coach. Between Chris's injury issues and now this apparent temper issue, Dragan Bender has had plenty of chances to seize that starting power forward job, has not really been able to do so. However, going back to the Bucks, I thought this is interesting. This isn't necessarily news now, but Zach Lowe wrote a nice column. He's been quite prolific of late on the Jason Kidd firing and just the state of the Bucks at this point and how they're going to get a second star. Jabari Parker returned over the weekend. I thought he looked decent in terms of his explosiveness. The jump shot looked good. Spacey as ever, basically on defense in that Nets game on Sunday. But the more interesting thing from Lowe's piece was apparently the Bucks were offering in the neighborhood, maybe it never got firmed up, but in the neighborhood of $18 million per season, a three-year deal worth $54 million. And for me, that's just an example. You know, Jabari Parker, oh man, he was the number two pick in the draft. Like, he's not taking that. Like, no one wants to take this. Well, you know, when you consider A, the 2018 market in general, B, the fact that the guy wasn't even healthy at the time and was coming off of two ACL tears in the same knee, and just, and I know he's gotten paid reasonably well as the number two pick already, but to lock in another $54 million when you've basically missed two full years of your career due to injury, and it's not even clear if Jabari is an $18 million player, even though he scored very well last year, as of right now, when healthy, that to me is a perfect example of how agent incentives, and maybe the agent said, hey, take it, and Jabari said, hell no, you know, you never know. But in general, we've talked about this before, that especially with extensions, agents' incentives are to hold out for more money. I mean, now, of course, they could get themselves paid early on, but in terms of like their perception in the industry, their incentives are never sign someone to a deal that could become below market, because that's what gets held up as, oh, you didn't believe in this guy, and now he's really outperformed that he didn't believe in you, now you should go with me. Or for other people, yeah, he always settles for lowball offers. Well, either they don't get publicized or what, but you could go back to Nerlens Noel with this. You can go back to maybe Marcus Smart is another guy. The Celtics reportedly offered something pretty far into eight figures per season that he didn't take, and there's no way he's getting that much that I can come up with on the restricted free agent market this year. But agents just don't want to find a deal that could end up being below market because they think it makes them look bad, and it never ends up, people, you know, rival agents aren't like, oh yeah, he didn't take care of his guy because he had this deal and didn't sign it. Like, that doesn't get out there publicly. It can't be used as ammo in the same way. So kind of a shame there. I think, granted, you know, know, as someone who's never played NBA basketball, I probably have a different mindset than someone that, like Jabari. But I mean, you know, the guy's only like 22, 23. Like, he could get $54 million, and if he outplays that, it's only 3 years, and he could have plenty of time to cash in after that's over.
One other sticky factor that I think is a part of this, just on a human level, is a lot of these players seeing the guys that got paid in 2016.
Oh, for sure.
And saying, I'm better than that guy. That guy got paid, and that there's no amount of coaching by an agent that can get your brain off that. I mean, for Nerlens, you could talk about guys like Myers Leonard, be like, oh, I'm way better than him, and look at how much money he got. And the funhouse mirror of that, while that's something you and I talked about before it happened, during, and of course after, as we've been all dealing with the fallout, players, they're aware of that. For people who've listened to The Breakaway, I thought there was an interesting part that that Rob Mahoney had, different Rob, on with the money part of leadership and all that kind of stuff. And it is, when we're trying to predict things, you do want to get into that realm of it. And I can imagine how pissed off some of the guys were last year, and it's going to be so much worse for restricted free agents this year, because they're going to have these expectations, in many cases, of eight figures, and there just aren't teams that are going to offer it at all.
Yeah, and Brian Windhorst and Bobby Marks had a piece again. Marks and Tim McMahon had a piece back in the offseason. We've been talking about it and talking about it and talking about it, that the market for, unless you're just an absolute elite player, and you're going to have basically, if you consider that teams like the Bulls and maybe Suns and Hawks are not going to really be in the free agent market, when you consider that, there's maybe four teams that are going to be able to offer anyone, restricted, unrestricted, more than the full mid-level exception. And then even probably half the league is going to be so close to the tax that they won't even be able to use the full mid-level exception unless to be the taxpayer, or maybe even less than that, because 12 teams right now are slated to be tax teams unless they change things up. It's going to be ugly for sure. Also ugly has been Shabazz Muhammad's situation in Minnesota. He would like to a trade or buyout, but he also has a player option for next year, and I'm guessing he won't be giving up too much of that. Both he and Jamal Crawford apparently were assured that they would be a larger part of the rotation than they've been, but Muhammad has been absolutely awful this year. The Wolves have been awful when he's been on the floor, and so remains to be seen what happens with him. Still, maybe, potentially, although this wanes with each passing year of his career, a guy who might be an okay scorer for a team off the bench, but just has never been willing to make the defensive effort, despite having some pretty decent tools on that end, that might actually make him anything more than just a potentially intriguing scorer at times.
And the challenge of negotiating, theoretically, let's call it a buyout, with a player with a player option is complicated. It actually is something that the Wolves have done before, not this front office, but when they were with Kevin Martin, actually. When they got Kevin Martin, he had that player option, and they ended up, I believe it was, he got a buyout and they stretched it. There was all that stuff going on.
He gave back a lot and never actually ended up making that money back. He retired at the end of that year, as it turned out, after signing for the minimum with Spurs.
Let's do a couple signings. DeAndre Liggins, who had a 10-day contract with the New Orleans Pelicans, he is back now on a 2-year contract. I have not yet heard. I would assume it's either light or no guarantees on that second year. You know, there are a couple times every season there's a guy who gets that kind of rest of season and then something for the next year. And Liggins works hard on defense. You know, there are reasons why Jason Kidd wanted to play him as a part of the rotation. Gentry has done that at times too, but his limitations as a shooter exacerbate some already existing problems with the Pelicans. It's so strange that the same thing happened with the Bucks, and they're just two teams that can use parts of his game, but the whole picture is a little bit of a challenge. But, you know, happy for him that he gets a spot locked in for the league for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I think especially considering the Pels' issues with the tax and the hard cap, not the direction that I would have gone. I would have tried to maybe sign another couple of 10 days. And I mean, maybe Liggins, if he goes and signs elsewhere, fine. But why would you limit yourself? You could potentially get someone on the buyout market. Why would you limit yourself now with Liggins, who I just don't, he's a terrible fit with Rajon Rondo, as we'll talk about in today's game, and not a guy who has really any kind of upside from a shooting standpoint. So would not be the direction that I would have gone. I think he's shown that he is very, very fringy and just not the kind of guy that the Pels should be looking for at this point. Just given the opportunity cost in particular, given how close they are to the tax. I mean, why not? I think we have such a good enough idea of what Liggins is at this point. I would rather just cycle through 10 days of guys in the G League and hope you find some new sticks. I think that's a better use of your money than it is Liggins. And then now you're also taking away a spot that you potentially could have used on a buyout guy later. You never know who's going to come available.
They also signed a 10-day contract for Emeka Okafor, which is exciting because he hasn't been in the league in such a long time. I believe the last time he played in the NBA was in the 2012-2013 season, so it's a long time for him to come back. He did play in the game today against the Utah Jazz, and because I'm a nerd about this sort of thing, I realized over the weekend that we're going to see, not that they're I believe they're distant relations, but we're going to see Okafor versus Okafor on Saturday, because Emeka's Pelicans will play Jaleel's Nets, and that's the first time in NBA history, and I'm excited about that because I'm crazy.
Nothing to add there. I think you've summed that up quite nicely. Scal Labissiere is out 2 to 3 weeks, one less reason to watch the Kings. He's got a left shoulder strain, so that should put him out through the All-Star break, you would imagine. Jordan Bell, you remember he suffered that scary ankle sprain against the Bulls a few weeks ago. He's progressing, is able to do at least spot shooting, but he won't be reassessed until after the All-Star break himself. I also wanted to give some credit to a Reddit user. After Mark Stein and I were talking about how with certain players, their contract, yeah, they don't get a no trade, but the contract is so heinous that it is the no trade. And so Drew P. Doan on Reddit suggested the term Noah trade clause for such a contract, which I think is outstanding. And I hope we will remember to use that.
Yeah, it's good. I am still, you know, hard of the belief that no contract is truly untradeable, but it's still a great term. And I think it conveys something perfectly, which is the idea that nobody wants that deal. And really, like Luol Deng's contract, his former teammate, where it's the only way that it happens is a trade that's so big and ridiculous that you don't even really want to project it.
Last thing here before we talk some games, Zach Lowe went through and he, based on reporting, is saying a lot of things that we have been warning about, which is essentially there are not many buyers right now. Nobody wants to take on money for next year. And where the first round pick comes from for the likes of Lou Williams or the likes of Tyreek Evans is really difficult to project right now, because there are a few teams that sort of a player can help that feel like, you know, that's going to help us get to the finals or even the conference finals or much less to beat Golden State. He did say that Golden State is looking maybe for something else on the wing. I think that need is starting to become pretty clear with some of their recent struggles. A guy who can hit shots in the wing and not be as bad as Nick Young defensively, I don't know if that guy necessarily is out there, but it does look like at this point, for teams that really do want an upgrade, they may come cheaper than what people expect and what the traditional cost has been, just because even the teams that are selling those guys like the Clippers or Memphis don't really want to take on long-term money. And so if there's a way to just send back someone who's expiring to get a guy who can play, and maybe Golden State would be interested in giving up their first rounder, though certainly with their tax concerns coming up, they might be loath to do that.
I wanted to connect with something there that also something that goes back actually to, I tried to convey this to people back when I used to work in tickets, which is what made ticket selling such a weird commodity is that at a certain point, unlike stocks, it goes to zero value because you can't trade it in that. It's when the event happens. And with this, it's like with Aristan Ilyasova or Marco Bellinelli, once the trade deadline happens, you can't get anything for them. So at a certain point, if let's say the Hawks say,
you might as well sell the ticket for $2,
right?
Or even
exactly
50 cents or whatever, because it's, and I think the Bulls were starting, to realize that to some extent with Mirotić, and that's maybe why that deal, which we probably thought just based on value was lopsided in favor of the Pelicans, the Bulls were like, hey, you know what, he's about to be worth nothing to us. I mean, not nothing, but, and it actually helped them to get off of him, in fact, because they were gonna then win more games if he was still on the team. So maybe the Bulls did well to act early, and these other teams will just, you know, the market's not necessarily going to materialize. I guess we'll find out about that, but I thought that's a good analogy. And then another thing that I thought about too, and this is from listening to Woj's and Zach Lowe's podcast today, but it's something that we said, I think, going back to the summer, just, you know, based on our own speculation, is if you're Dan Gilbert, and, you know, there's all this talk about them moving the Brooklyn pick, and, you know, you got to get LeBron to say, like, that's, you got this superstar in your prime, you got to get him to stay. And I agree, if Dan Gilbert were sane, that probably would be the case. But try to get in his head a little bit here, right? Okay, you've got LeBron James. That's true. LeBron screwed you over once. You've got a terrible relationship with him now. He gets all the credit when you win. You don't really like the guy. And oh, by the way, yeah, okay, you have a chance to get to the finals every year, but most people would probably say that they don't have a realistic chance of beating this Golden State team. If Kevin Durant weren't in Golden State, maybe it's a little bit different. So, okay, yeah, you can get to the finals again, but you're not winning a championship and you're losing $25 million per season. That's what they lost last year. They're in the repeater tax this year. It could be even worse now. And no real way to get better. So even if you were able to keep LeBron, and it's not like you can then, you know, keep him in and sell the team. Maybe that's the only way that it could be worth it economically, is if they could get him on a long-term deal and then sell the team. But, you know, the idea of, hey, we got to keep him around to sell the team, he's going to leave anyway, and you can't sell the team to get that equity. They're probably going to lose, you know, a lot of value once he leaves, but I don't think there's anything they can do about that at this point. So to almost certainly not win an NBA championship, deal with all these headaches, and lose $25 million a year, you could see how maybe Dan Gilbert is thinking, hey, you know what, if he leaves, it's not the end of the world.
There's one other big element of this, and I've been watching this play out and largely kind of sat it out on Twitter, which is that LeBron has been such a zealous advocate for getting his teammates paid, and he can do that. It's his prerogative if that's the way he wants to handle it. But those contracts to Tristan Thompson, to J.R. Smith in particular, are now prohibitive. And some of that is those guys not living up to expectations, but they were zealously advocated for by the kingmaker in their franchise, and they got
well. They don't win the 2016 championship without Tristan Thompson's ability to switch and get offensive rebounds. So I thought that was a reasonable contract at the time, and then Smith as well.
But if LeBron is lamenting publicly kind of certain parts about the team's competitiveness, it's like, well, if those guys had a little bit more manageable contracts, even if you agree that they're valuable, then maybe you could get them for somebody better. But I mean, J.R. Smith's contract obviously fails the Nene test. Tristan Thompson's is close. I mean, depending on how you see it, and the fact that it has another couple of years is certainly spooking some teams. We've talked about how reluctant they are to take on money. So I understand why those deals happen. I support it. I wrote a piece for the Sporting News saying this is why you pay Tristan Thompson. That was before they won the title. But those things do have consequences, and it also makes it harder for Cleveland to get out from under this should LeBron end up leaving. I'm not saying it's not worth it, because they won a championship and that's a huge thing for them long term, but all of these things are a challenge. And I would assume, I think this is fair to say, that LeBron probably had a voice in why this Cleveland team has signed so many more past their prime players who are good before they are right now, as opposed to using those contracts on other ones. And certain ones like Dwayne Wade for the minimum, obviously that's a steal, but like, you know, going for Jose Calderon and Jeff Green and all that kind of stuff, like, I don't know if LeBron was involved in that, but it certainly seems like something he would have supported.
All right, let's nothing more to add there. Let's get to this Detroit Portland game. Portland coming off a back-to-back. They had an emotional loss yesterday afternoon in Boston. Amazing shot making. That was actually going to be a candidate for one of the games of the month as well. But eventually Al Horford hit an incredible fadeaway shot to win the game. They come in the next night, and this was a pretty rough loss for the Blazers, 111-91 to the Pistons, who have won three straight since the acquisition of Blake Griffin.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the big questions that we all had was, how is the synergy going to be between Blake Griffin and Andre Drummond? And while there are certain elements of it that are concerning, the passing and the interplay between those guys, we're less than a week in now. That interplay, I think, really did shine in certain elements of this game.
Yeah, Blake, I don't think he's going to be that efficient. He kicked it off early at 10 points in the first on 4 of 8, ended 9 of 20 from the field, did not get to the foul line once, actually, 21 points. So that's one of the bigger drop-offs in Blake's game, is he's just not, number one, like, teams don't have to double him as much, and he just doesn't quite have the explosion to beat guys to the spot and then go through them at the rim and get fouled. But so a lot of it is the mid-range jumper for Blake, but he does a decent job of creating shots. He's a great passer, had 6 assists in this one, including a few to Drummond, as you noted. And he gives this offense just somewhere to go for so much of the time, especially playing a fair amount of time with the second unit without Ish Smith, who's really their only viable point guard on the roster right now. So I thought he played well. I mean, he's not a beast in the post. He was not really effective getting good shots. I mean, if you were to look at all of Blake's shots in this game, maybe like one or two of them were shots that you'd be like, hey, you know, that's a good shot, you know, where he's wide open. I mean, maybe a few open threes. He was 3 out of 7 on threes, and he's hitting that well enough now to where that's a good shot for him. But he's not really creating a ton of separation anymore. He had one play where he faked out Yusuf Nurkic with a spin move for a layup that was pretty good. But given where the Pistons were offensively before acquiring him, I thought that he's going to help them, and maybe a little bit more than I realized. And part of the reason for that as well is that they have been getting better than expected play from some of their wings who are less heralded.
They have been, and I thought this game was a really impressive performance for Gan Van Stundy. And why I say that is because look at the perimeter guys that were impressive in this game. Anthony Tolliver, for counting him because he hit a couple threes. Langston Galloway did a nice job on the bench. Rodney, Reggie Bullock, who I thought he did a nice job overall on both ends of the floor, hit some open shots, competed on defense.
Yeah. Bullock in particular has been a massive find for them. He was 3 of 5 on threes. He's shooting almost 45% from 3-point range. And he is not a lockdown defender. He's good enough. You know, he wasn't getting killed by Dame Lillard and CJ in part two because they did a very nice job of getting out on the floor and making those guys give the ball up. Andre Drummond, I thought, had a few defensive lapses, but overall had a very nice defensive game, as he has the last couple of times that I've seen him. He was great in that Utah game last month as well, which was the last time I think I watched a full Pistons game before this. And so the defense looked quite stifling. And what I liked about their offense, this team takes a lot of mid-rangers, and it's tough to be efficient on a night-to-night basis, but it at least plays into their hands against a team like Portland, who, as we know, is very analytically focused. And so whether it was Griffin taking long twos, and then the other thing that the Pistons have been doing a ton of this year is either screening away for guys coming off of wide pin downs in the corner, or bring guys out of the corner for DHOs, and they were able to have those guys come off and get right to the free throw line and just get wide open shots at the free throw line time and time again, and they were knocking those down in this game. Luke Kennard was pretty solid with that. Stanley Johnson, his decision making wasn't great. We'll talk about that a little more, but had a couple of looks there. Even Ish
Galloway
Smith
had
a couple of looks there. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they were able, you can kind of see the idea. And Portland has been, we talked about this on the awards column, they haven't been as great defensively in January as they were the early part of the year. I mean, they still do a lot of the right things out there. The reason I originally wasn't as enthused about this game was not only was it the tail end of a back-to-back, but it was also the fifth game in 7 nights for the Blazers. So you could see some of that cumulative fatigue with them offensively and defensively. But I mean, I also was impressed with the Pistons. And one of the overarching things that I think is important to be thinking about this time of year, especially as now that the deadline has moved up, is really how the East is shaking out. Where right now, depending on how you see Charlotte, and I still consider Charlotte on the outside looking in, there are 9 teams going for 8 spots. And so the question was kind of, can Detroit, now they're at 500 after winning this game, where are they going to fit into that? And I think what they're doing is they're putting a lot of heat now on everybody above them, saying, not only do you guys need to stay healthy, but you need to play well because we're coming for that. And they can keep moving up because there isn't that much separation between these teams.
Yeah. Now, I think all of these games have been at home, and they beat Memphis at home in a close game in Blake's first game. I think it was the Pacers the game after that. And then it was this one against the Blazers. So some decent wins. This one was a blowout. The first two were close wins. But now the Pistons are back up to 50% playoff odds. They're even at 26 and 26. And while the rest of the teams are pretty far above them in the standings, except the Sixers, who are also at 500 right now, but have a better point differential than the Pistons, these 3 wins were huge. I mean, just to get back on track. And I mean, remember, they were just an absolute free fall right before the Blake trade, other than getting that win over the Cavaliers, which when the Cavaliers are on the road, they're like one of the worst teams in the NBA these days. So that doesn't mean as much as it used to.
Oh, can I game something out quick also? So their schedule before the All-Star break is really favorable. So they play Brooklyn, the Clippers, the Pelicans, and the Hawks all at home. And their only road game is in Atlanta. So there are a couple challenging games. I mean, obviously New Orleans is still a very good team, and the Clippers have been competitive in Brooklyn. But if that is a slate where they can keep building on this momentum and be happy with where they are, and this was their big move, so I think they can be, you know, they're not going to be looking to really do something else, I'm guessing, at the trade deadline, though I've been wrong on that before.
A few other notes from this one. Be hard pressed to find a Blazer who played particularly well. Probably Ed Davis, who had 6 offensive rebounds and actually was giving Andre Drummond some trouble with his quickness on the offensive glass, as Drummond is not the greatest box out guy in the world. He likes to just go get the ball, and Davis was able to kind of slither around him as he can do. But other than that, no one really played that well for the Blazers. Evan Turner didn't play due to a calf injury in this one. Not quite sure how long he's going to be out. So they started Aminu and Harkless. Harkless was on fire against Boston on Sunday, but did not have the touch today. Aminu as well was asked to do a lot more off the bounce than they usually like him to, in part again because Drummond was so good. I mean, he really bothers guys on those traps. He can get a hand in, get a steal, and then recover back pretty quickly with his lateral mobility. Zach Collins had a really rough night. The combination of he and Davis has been solid together, but Collins was 1 out of 8, and he's a guy who plays hard and has some athletic advantages, but he doesn't really know what to do when he doesn't have the athletic advantage. Like, he tried to go in and just shoot a regular straight layup with no craft at all on Andre Drummond and just got it thrown back in his face twice in a row, and just looked like a rookie out there tonight. He's had some moments, but this was not one of his better games. And then CJ McCollum was really shut down. He was negative 28 in this one. I think he only had like 2 points after the first quarter, and Dame was okay, but it wasn't like a transcendent night for him, and he also had 5 turnovers. So I thought the Pistons did well. Portland certainly looked tired. And then for Detroit, though, Stanley Johnson, I thought he played pretty well defensively. I thought he and Detroit's wings in general were effective, taking away a lot of those flare screens that the Blazers like to run. And he did a good job of being physical with CJ. Did not really seem to get beat off the bounce too often when he was matched up one-on-one, but his offensive decision making still is kind of vexing for me.
And it's hard because at certain moments, just the way the Pistons offense works, they're going to put him in a position where he has a decision to make. I mean, if he's coming off a DHO or something like that, where you're trusting your player and you're putting the ball in his hands, and he has the tough combination of a lot of confidence in his ability, like, to get to the rim. I don't consider him a particularly great finisher, and not really having much of a jump shot. So I think that you're kind of creating circumstances that are good. Like, that's what you want your offense to do, is to put guys in a position to succeed, but I'm not sure it's putting him in a position to succeed. And that creates a challenge because you're not going to totally retool your offense because of Stanley Johnson. So you're just kind of sitting there going, well, he's one of your best options right now, especially with the defensive value he can provide. And maybe you just have to roll with that. But I'm going to be interested to see, now that they have this perimeter rotation that they have now, who plays in which roles and how they make this work. Because with Stanley, it seems like at least a portion of his play is incorrigible, is a little bit strong, but it's not really something that you can fix during this season.
Yeah, and he's got maybe more ball handling ability than just your typical three, but the lack of rise on his jump shot, he's got kind of a low release. It doesn't go in. We talked about how he's shooting about 25% on jumpers off the dribble, and then the lack of explosion at the rim, which you alluded to. You know, he can get a shoulder past his guy sometimes, but then a lot of times just doesn't have a plan. He'll miss passes. It just makes bad decisions to either shoot off the bounce or go into a bunch of guys where he is not really able to either finish or get a good passing lane to kick out. So I think, you know, his usage is not exactly astronomical. It'll probably go up a little bit now with the Tobias Harris on another team. They just need someone to do some stuff off the dribble. But I think that he would still be well served to kind of focus a little bit more on the spot up opportunities and transition, and, you know, try to just get into the paint, break the paint, and then maybe just keep the ball moving instead of trying to get all the way to the rim where he's just not going to be able to finish over any kind of a test. Also for Portland. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
There's one other thing I wanted to bring up for the Pistons. Partially, I there are a couple other factors that I'm not completely sharp on, but I liked that they ran basically a three big rotation. They, Tolliver was playing really well, so they played Drummond, Blake Griffin, and Tolliver. Those guys, you know, Tolliver 27 minutes, Blake 30, Drummond 34. You can make that work as a team, especially in the modern NBA. A lot of times that was playing Blake as the second unit center, and I think it worked. And Portland going as big as they did, you would think that that might be a challenge, but I thought they did totally fine.
Yeah, Tolliver is shooting 41% from three-point range this year. Galloway has been excellent from outside as well. They have guys who can shoot, and hopefully Blake can play make for them a little bit more, or at least have the space to go to work down low, although how much he can really beat those matchups still remains to be seen. But the Pistons won this one in large part on great three-point shooting, 15 out of 30, and defense as well. They're 15 out of 30 from downtown, while the Blazers struggled to 10 out of 33. Yusuf Nurkic, I thought just his finishing, he just still suffers from when he can't get a shoulder into a guy. He'll catch it on the pick and roll, and if you just lay back on him, he's just going to kind of careen into the paint and throw some crap up, and sometimes it'll bounce in, but it doesn't look very good. It'll get a lot of shots blocked. He's trying to release it quickly so he doesn't get it blocked. And so some of the pick and roll magic that he had late last year when he first came to Portland, you know, he hasn't quite been able to replicate that as much this season. All right, let's do a read, and then we'll get to Utah and New Orleans. The Jazz have been absolutely on fire lately. And should you like to go see them in person, seriously, the Jazz has been really fun lately. I'm not lying about that. SeatGeek is the best way to do that. They're giving us a special offer. I know you've heard me do a read for SeatGeek many, many times before. You can use that CatSpace code to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase, or they have a special NBA offer running through All-Star Weekend. If you're a first-time purchaser, you can get $30 off any NBA ticket between now and February 19th. There's a different promo code for that. It's DUNKED, D-U-N-K-E-D, UNCD. So sorry to give you another promo code because we always try to do cap space, but different one here. Dunked, $30 off any NBA purchase. It could be for any game. It just, you got to actually make the purchase through All-Star Weekend. So even if you've been looking at an April matchup or something, you can act now and you can save $30 with that promo code Dunked, D-U-N-C-D, for $30 off NBA tickets. Or you can still get the $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase for anything else other than NBA using the promo code CAPSPACE. And SeatGeek, again, real quickly, the reason to use it, aggregates ticket selling sites together, so no more headaches about having to go to a bunch of different sites, and then saves you both time and money by ranking every ticket based on value. So you just see where the biggest, darkest green dot is, click on that, and that'll give you your best value as you're looking through with SeatGeek. So you use that Dunked, D-U-N-C-D, for $30 off NBA tickets, or the normal CAPSPACE code, $20 off any first-time purchase of anything. So let's get to Utah and New Orleans here. What were your overarching thoughts on this one?
I mean, the Jazz are an absolute buzzsaw right now. I was impressed with the quality of looks they were generating. One of the things that they're able to do, just because they know the angles, like Ricky Rubio had a couple of just beautiful passes to Gobert where there wasn't a big window, but he got it in and he knows exactly how far Gobert's arms can reach and could get it in. And so they were able to generate much more reliable offense than the Pelicans were. And this game was, it was closer at halftime. And part of that was because Rajon Rondo actually hit a couple threes. And you think about if those sort of things regress the mean, they could have been taking control of this game even earlier than they did.
Yeah, and they themselves were extremely hot in the first half. They were 10 of 11 on three-pointers in the first half, but then only managed 3 out of 10 in the second half, and they still put up 60 points on this Pelicans team in the second half after 70 in the first half. And I mean, Rubio has been playing unbelievably well. He had a career-high 34 points, I believe, against the Suns over the weekend, and Utah has now scored over 120 in 4 straight games, and they've scored 129 or more in 3 of those 4 games, including beating the Warriors by 30 at home. They beat the Suns by 30 on the road. They just beat the Pels by 24 in this one, 133-109. And then they beat the Spurs on the second night of a back-to-back by 9, putting up a buck 20 on them as well. And even in these last 2 games, Donovan Mitchell has been a non-factor. He was ill for the Spurs game, and then this one only played 19 minutes, did not appear to be himself, as Drew Holiday and Liggins really caused some problems. Mitchell was only 1 out of 6 for 2 points. He had a nice reverse dunk, or I'm sorry, backdoor dunk on alley-oop, and that was basically it. The big star, though, was Rodney Hood, 30 points on 15 shooting possessions. That's efficient.
It's almost as efficient as it gets. He was 4 of 4 on threes, and then he was 8 of 10 on twos, which is absolutely incredible. Yeah. And for those of us who have been, I mean, I think I picked Rodney Hood 2 years in a row for most improved player, and the reason why was just because his offensive...
Like as your prediction for who would be the most... Yeah,
not as the actual winner for either of those years. but the reason why is because you see that kind of potential that he can do. He's capable with the ball in his hands. He can also catch and shoot. And I still, especially with that his defense hasn't gotten to the level that he always wanted to, I think he's better served coming off the bench, you know, being a high volume bench guy rather than being a starter on a good team. I think that's the best role for him. But still, those players who have wing size are incredibly valuable around the league. And I don't think a game like this should necessarily change the way teams evaluate him, but it can be a reminder of, oh yeah, this guy's a good player. And as something we talked about earlier in this broadcast, and I actually wrote about this for The Athletic today, trading for pending restricted free agents, I think we're going to see one or two teams make really, really smart moves in that direction that could be keeping a guy, like it could be with Aaron Gordon or something like that, or it could be acquiring somebody, because if the market dries up, you could be getting these guys at incredible value.
Yeah, or maybe they just decide, screw it, I'm taking the qualifying offer.
Still
and,
cheap.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see in the 2019 free agent market will be better, but my prediction is we're going to see a lot of guys doing cheapo deals with player options for next year and just, you know, kind of chasing that 2019 money a little bit more when it becomes clear how miserable the market is. But Hood, I mean, 6'8 guys who can rise up over just about anybody and get their shot. And then he was also able to use the threat of that. You know, he'd come to the free throw line, 1-2, looked like he was going to stop and pop. And a couple of times he got shorter defenders to overcommit because they're like, oh man, he's about to rise up. I better like jump early so to have some prayer contesting this thing. And so he gets guys in the air and then he steps through for a nice floater. He's got that move as well. Didn't really show much defensively. He got beat a couple times in isolation by Drew Holiday, who just like went right through him. I thought it was really not very good intensity or strength by Hood on those plays, but he's not a terrible defender. And his ability to just shoot threes off the bounce and shoot, you know, high 30s, 40% is very impressive. It's just, you know, he can't stay healthy on this Jazz team, which is a problem. And it seems like they really want to move him. I probably would not be, just because I think he gives you some upside there. He's also really inconsistent as well. That's another thing. Another thing that I thought was of note for the Jazz here, with Jonas Jerebko didn't play particularly well, and then the Jazz starting both halves extremely well. Usually it's all token and they take Derek Favors out after 3 minutes, but they actually played Gobert and Favors together quite a bit in this one, and it was really effective for one of the few times this season.
It was effective despite New Orleans in his first start. He played over the weekend, but Nikola Mirotic started this game, and you think in certain circumstances that could compromise the opposing defense if you have somebody who Favors, like we both think of him as more of a five than a four, playing against a shooting power forward. But I thought that didn't compromise them as much as I expected it to, and then Favors was able to create advantages the other way because he's bigger and stronger than Mirotic.
Yeah, and while the Jazz, I mean, they didn't generate a ton of three-point looks with only 21, obviously they shot it extremely well. And Ricky Rubio, usually it's been, well, Rubio and Favors and Gobert together, and you're just not going to have the spacing. But against what was a porous New Orleans defense, Rubio, although Rajon Rondo ended up with 18 points, I think all of them might have even been in the first half, I want to say. I don't think he scored in the second half, and he ended up negative 19. By the way, Rondo, the Pels were 8-4 in their last 12 coming in. Rondo still somehow only had a positive plus minus in two of those games, and I think he was even in a third of them. They are still playing pretty poorly with him on the floor.
And remember where his minutes are. Like, that's not even...
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
He's playing with it. You know, it's kind of like the Zaza Pachulia thing. You play all your minutes with your team's best players, and your team still doesn't do well when you're on the floor. And I'm noting Pachulia, yeah. That's not been true this year, but that was true to a point last year.
Yeah, and Rondo just got absolutely torched by Rubio in this one. And, you know, part of the problem there was that usually if you can just get under and meet Rubio on the other side, or at least just like kind of compete enough so that he has to think about it if you go under, but you still kind of get a hand up and he can't just like measure up the shot. Or you just compete and stay on his back and it's tough for him to finish, and your big doesn't have to fully commit. Well, Rubio was just getting into the lane time and time again in this one, and he just threw some unbelievable passes. He also he's got more confidence finishing around the rim. That's something David Locke's been noting too. He had one play late in this one where he drove in, you know, completely unmolested, of course, from the guard. He's got AD back there, and he does like an awesome, like quick yo-yo dribble, fake pass, totally freezes AD, and then just shoots a nice little finger roll over him. It was, you know, not the sort of play you're used to seeing from Ricky Rubio, finishing over a shot blocker of Davis's caliber. And then the Jazz centers were also just fantastic defensively. Epe Udo had a couple of nasty blocks late in the third quarter, including one where he just pinned AD's shot between the rim and the backboard for a jump ball. And Gobert was really difficult to score on inside it as well. And he is looking better offensively now, calming down a little bit with his finishes. And he had 19 points on 7 out of 8 from the field and 10 rebounds in 33 minutes. So he was looking good. Favors hit a couple of threes as well. He was 2-2 on threes. So everything working right now for the Jazz. Anything else you want to add from the Pels side on this one?
Not particularly. Well, Shake Diallo didn't have a great game. I thought that was a little bit of a concern, and that might be part of why...
Well, it's interesting. Dante Cunningham got a DMP coach's decision. I'm not sure why that would have been. He's not listed, I don't think, on their injury report. So I don't know why they were playing guys like Liggins and Diallo over Dante Cunningham at the four. I mean, maybe they felt like, hey, you know, we have to get another center out there, but they had Okafor, they had Diallo. So yeah, maybe Cunningham's injured and I just didn't see it, but I checked their Roto-World injury report. He's not listed on there. And then Drew Holiday continues. I mean, maybe I just happened to catch his good games, but he just caused absolute misery for Donovan Mitchell in this one. We saw him play great defense against Kyrie Irving earlier earlier in the season, and then he was by far the best offensive guy, 28 points, 13 out of 21. And interestingly enough, we have not mentioned the name of Anthony Davis yet. He had 15 points on 6 out of 16 and did nothing in the second half. And it was interesting that this was against the Jazz, because this is one of those games that David Locke talks about where Anthony Davis just has like a huge variance in his performance from game to game. And if he has a lot of games where he plays poorly, I mean, the Pels just aren't going to win when he plays poorly. And so he is pretty inconsistent. Again, we've speculated as to what the reasons for that might be, whether it's, you know, he's more of a defensive player offensively, or just there's something about his game, or he just, you know, maybe physically he doesn't feel that good from game to game. You know, he's always got these nagging injuries, but whatever it is, that continues to be the case where he'll have a lot more inexplicably bad games, and then just some completely monster games too on occasion. He's the least consistent superstar in the NBA.
I was particularly excited to see him in this one because with DeMarcus Cousins being out, that meant he and Gobert were squaring off a lot more often. And it,
yeah, oh, Gobert, man, did great matched up on him. Really did. AD had no chance to score on him one-on-one. Yeah. Like, if he was going to score, it would have had to have been, you know, pick and pop, draw him away from the hoop type of stuff.
Right, and there isn't really enough created on those sorts of plays sometimes for the Pelicans to, you can use it, of course, it should be a part of your offense. But, that was definitely a concern for Davis, and he is going to have to be their anchor on both ends of the floor moving forward, as well as Drew Holiday has played as a facilitator at moments and as a scorer at other points. It is Anthony Davis's team, and this is a, you know, I was sitting there before this game started, and I was kind of going, okay, you know, like, yeah, Utah's been playing super well, but before this game, Utah was 4 games under 500, and the Pelicans were 4 games over 500. So you're sitting there going, like, that's a big, big difference when you have fewer than 30 games left. And so I was sitting there going, okay, well, what's going to happen? And then you watch this game, and you go, well, crap, I mean, how good are the Jazz going to be the rest of this season? Like, if they're a 45 or even a 50-win pace team for the rest of this season, they'll blow through that 500 mark. And if the Pelicans are, you know, they can certainly win games, and I think they will. But I thought that was kind of far-fetched when the day started, and I'm feeling like that was a little bit of an overstatement for me, just thinking more about banked wins than what they could do from here on out.
The Utah Jazz, despite a 25-28 record, are now projected for the 6th seed by 538, tied with the Trailblazers with a 44-38 record, in part because, I mean, they've had these four almost blowout wins. I mean, they've won 3 games by 24 points or more out of their last 4, and one was against the Warriors and 3 were on the road. So that's pretty impressive for the Jazz. Now, of course, Gobert has been relatively injury prone these last 2-3 years. Hood can go down at any time. Rubio is playing out of his mind. You know, they're not going to keep playing like this, to be sure. We'll see what the trade deadline brings for them as well, where they are going to try and move Hood or Favors. That could maybe put a crimp in their plans as well, but they certainly are having one of the great stretches of this season. And for the Pels, they were playing Rondo and Liggins together for massive portions of this game. And Rondo, now he hit 4 three-pointers in the first half, and then Drew hit this impossible step back. All 4 of Rondo's threes occurred in like the last 3 minutes of the half. So in a span of 5 possessions, the Jazz forced 4 Rondo threes and a really tough Drew Holiday step back going for the 2-for-1, and the Pels made all 5 of them. But you knew, especially with Rondo, that wasn't going to happen. I think he did, in fact, score 0 points in the second half. And they had Rubio guarding him, and Rubio is such a smart help defender that he was really able to gum up the works for a lot of the stuff that they were trying to do, in particular for AD. And it's a little frustrating when, oh, thank God they finally got this stretch for Nikola Mirotic. Like, they're finally going to get some space around AD, and now they're going to play Rondo and Liggins together around it and just completely blow all of that spacing that they have.
Something else I'm happy you brought it up that I heartily enjoy, and we don't see enough because teams go the other direction. So when a team has a limited offensive player, a lot of coaches, for logical reasons, put an important offensive player who's a bad defender, James Harden is a great archetype for this, on that guy. And there is a value to that, especially if the player that he's guarding is less active, so they have to do less. And in Harden's case, that's always a really good thing. But there is such an intense value to having A, an intelligent, but B, a good help defender on that player, because they can just create so much more havoc. And I thought we got that in the Rubio game, and that's going to be less prevalent in the playoffs this year because Roberson isn't going to be out there, so it isn't going to be what I thought it was, but that's something that I always look for, and I thought Rubio in particular did a wonderful job of that in this game.
All right, that's a good one to close on here. Again, I want to remind you guys, cap space code with Wish, number one thing you guys can do to support us right now to help us get a long-term sponsorship for the Twitter NBA show, and and hopefully lead to us doing more of that as well, which would be awesome. So we really appreciate your support, but this is a special time really to make a difference in our endeavors. And so anything that y'all can do to help us there, and you know, especially considering how low their prices are with that cap space code on Wish, you're shouldn't be put out too much. I hope you should be able to find something that hopefully you want or need or both on Wish with that cap space code. And speaking of which, we will have the Twitter NBA show tomorrow, OKC at Warriors. So a little bit later of a start, probably around 7:25 Pacific or so for Thunder at Warriors. That'll be an interesting one. Both teams foundering to some degree, so we'll see who can turn it around. And we will talk to y'all tomorrow night. Till then.